At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Welcome to another real, raw, authentic episode of Sober.Buzz, hosted by me, Heidi Case, and my fiance, Josh Case, where we are spreading the good buzz. Our global community crosses cultures and has no international borders, as addiction and recovery is a human journey. Hope is found here. Today, we are joined by our good friend, Gabe Cohen. Who is Gabe Cohen? He's the founder of Discovery Cafe. His journey from challenging childhood through periods of homelessness and incarceration to becoming the leader figure in peer-based recovery support is a testament to the power of second chances and the human capacity for lasting change. Gabe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That was a very kind, humbling introduction. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Nice to see you, Gabe. Thanks for coming on.
Good to see you, Josh.
Thanks. If you have anything to fill in the gaps there about yourself?
I mean, not really. I think that's a good jumping off place. You know, currently executive director of Discovery Cafe, which we like to call a non-clinical peer-to-peer recovery support model in our community. We're in a rural community with very limited resources. And so, we saw a void in our community for people in recovery, tried to fill that void. And since then, we're in the local county jail with our group model and also an approved program in the Colorado Department of Corrections. We've been in several prisons and we own and operate a couple sober living homes in our community as well for justice-involved men.
And where are you at? You're in Rifle, Colorado?
Yeah. It's a small town called Rifle, Colorado. We're about, 50, 60 miles from Aspen, Colorado. So very affluent community. And then as you come, we call it coming down valley. Rifle's more rural and blue collar, if you will.
Well, that's a long way from New York.
Yeah. I grew up on Long Island, and that's a long story. I don't know where you want me to start, but I'm happy to start.
Start there. That's good.
All right. Well, grew up in middle-class suburbia, Long Island. It was very nice. I was very blessed, very nice place to live and to grow
up. What town in Long Island?
A little town called Centerport. About, people have heard, have you ever heard of Huntington, Long Island? So it's about 4 miles from Huntington. And I grew up, in a suburbia, Long Island. My parents weren't into drugs or alcohol, but I did experience some childhood sexual abuse, some trauma as a kid, and not in my home, outside of my home. Didn't really know what to do with that, the feelings, the trauma. When I was introduced to drugs and alcohol at about 13 years old, 12, 13, started using, started using cocaine, tried cocaine for the first time when I was 15 and fell in love with it. Like it was like, yeah, that was my drug of choice from then on. That same year when I was 15, I got arrested for the first time for a violent crime. And from there, really splintered my relationship with my family, my parents. Didn't do any juvenile time. I was, again, just very fortunate. Had a good attorney. And basically, I was just on probation till I was 18. But it was my first, involvement with law enforcement, or being arrested. By 17 years old, I was dealing cocaine, dropped out of high school, went to my first inpatient rehab when I was 18, made up my schoolwork. They allowed me to get my diploma, came home, and about 12 days after being back home, my parents found like half a pound of weed in my room and kicked me out. And, I was off and running. At that time, when things were going downhill pretty consistently, since I tried cocaine, but when I took my first hit of crack is really when, I was stealing cars. I was, writing hot checks. Then I was robbing drug dealers. And, by the time I was 19, I know how familiar you are with New York, but I was selling, $500 silk dresses out of the back of my car in Jamaica, Queens, in Ozone Park, that fell off the back of the trucks. Yeah. I joke about it now, but at that time I was in way over my head, dealing, involved with drugs and guns and I have an uncle that lives in Denver, Colorado. That's what brought me out to Colorado. He had a friend that was in Narcotics Anonymous, and obviously he was my mom's brother. My mom's passed away, but he's in his 80s, man. He's still going hard. He offered me, he said, I'll buy you a one-way ticket, but here's the rules. You can come out to our house. You got to get a job. And he had a friend that was in Narcotics Anonymous in NA. And he said, you go to meetings, work their program. He wasn't too familiar with recovery, but he knew about it, through this friend. And so I was like, bet, I had people that wouldn't mind finding me in a dark alley, at the time. And so I packed a duffel bag, got on an airplane, came out to Colorado and, was going to meetings. I was familiar with the 12-step program. Oh man, that was, 1990. That was in 1990. Yeah.
You've been out there about 35 years now.
Yeah. That's why I said, this is a long story. So I can fast forward. I can
that's
give
great.
You,
I'll
we
give
have plenty of time.
I'll give, all right. Well, thank you. I'll give you, the real bullet points here for me. I came out to Colorado and I stayed clean for 6 weeks. Yeah. Well, so that year was 1990, about 35 years ago. And, but I share that because here, so I burned all my bridges in New York. My parents basically wrote me off for dead, didn't want anything to do with me. Brothers, sisters, they were really, cause I did what crackheads do, which was, rob and steal from everybody around me to get that next hit. And so everyone's mad at me. I come out to Denver, Colorado. I get into recovery. I'm working at a health club. Things are going good. I meet a girl. I go to a party. I have a couple of drinks and I'm looking for, next thing I know, I'm on the streets looking for crack, right? And so I found some crack, they call it Capitol Hill, downtown Denver. And there's this street called East Colfax, which it was, I'm like, where would somebody go? Like if they wanted crack, and they said, go to Colfax, so bet. So I go down there. Anyways, I don't remember 2 or 3 day binge, but my uncle's like, my wife's, your aunt's freaking out. They had, my cousins were little back then. He's like, you're not welcome in our home. This is, I told you the deal. One way ticket, tough love, like you're on your own. So
your family actually had pretty good boundaries.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. My back home in New York, my mother was, you know, he's sick. We can't kick him out, you know, but my dad, my father was like, you know, he literally told me, you're going to live or you're going to die, but you can't do it here anymore. Cause we're like prisoners in our own home. Like
that's
we can't,
a lot of families
can't trust you.
Don't have those boundaries. So that's impressive on their part, as hard as it was on you, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was resentful. You know, it was all about me, right? Like how could you do this to me? Like, don't you understand? You know?
Yeah.
Like big deal. I stole your car and I wrecked it, but I'm still your son, you know?
Right.
And you know, but that gets old, right? Like,
yeah.
So, and I didn't, you know, I really didn't blame him, but we didn't talk for a couple of years. Like I was still trying to understand what was going on with me, right? Like how did this happen? And then all of a sudden I find myself, you know, I'm 2,000 miles or however far Denver is from New York. I'm halfway across the country, you know, and I take ownership. I mean, this was all because of my behavior, right? My actions. But at the time, you know, I'm a 19-year-old kid with a chip on my shoulder. Who thinks he's a tough guy because I'm from New York. And, you know, if you're from New York, you're supposed to be a tough guy. I soon
all
found
think
out.
You're tough at 19.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Thanks for showing me some grace.
Some people from New York act like they're a little too tough. But he's from Long Island. So,
yeah. It wasn't really me. Yeah. Yeah. Let's just keep it real, right? But, you know, my point is I got checked fast because here I am, you know, on the streets of Denver, which I never thought of like Denver being like a hard or tough city. Cause again, I'm a guy from New York, right? New York's a tough place, but they like, I wasn't familiar. They had gangs and gang banging and shootings. And, you know, I'm this like white kid in this other neighborhood now where I'm standing out like a green M&M, you know, at 3 a.m, you know what I mean? So I'm getting beat up. I'm getting robbed. Now I'm getting like misdemeanor arrests, you know, getting caught with crack pipe, breaking in the buildings, like when it was cold out, just to like find, you know, sleep in the laundry room, right? Like just trying to survive. So this started my new lived experience of going in and out of the city, county jail, you know, a couple days in jail, 2 months in jail. You know what? But every time I get out, I'm getting out homeless again. So I'm in and out of jail. I just go right back to the streets, go back to what I know, and I started.
And that's
you know
a
like
really big problem for so many people, right? I mean, they get out yes. of jail, they've got nothing to go to, and it's the recidivism. Like it just feeds you right back into the system.
Yeah.
Just this big, ugly circle where yeah. it never stops. You can't get off the ride.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like you get out of jail, you know, with a piece of paper and, you know, they want you to go, you know, to whatever this address is to go check in with probation. And then to this other address, you got this piece of paper with, you know, go over here to get food stamps. And then here's a shelter. I've got no money, no phone, no car, no job. You know, and so, you know, usually this just gets thrown in the trash and I'm looking for that next hit, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be that way, but that's the route, you know, so over time it was like, I guess this is my lot in life almost, you know, each time just chipping away at my own self-worth, my own self-esteem of, you know, I guess I'm going to overdose or someone's going to kill me out here, or I guess I'll be spending the rest of my life in prison because I don't know, you know. And when I say I tried recovery, you know, like I've been to rehab, right? I've been to NA, like nothing's working. So I guess this is my lot in life. And so I'm just going to kill the pain because it sucks.
So when you went to rehab, when you did sort of, you know, do the NA thing, like, were you there because you had to be probation wise or were you there because you wanted to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. Cause I work with justice involved individuals today. Right. And I see it a lot. So I would say like my first rehab, really, it was really like survival mode. Like I took on something that that I couldn't control, cocaine, right? And, you know, I was still on Long Island, but it was a way, like I dropped out of school. I tried to join the Army because I saw that as like a way out. I'm like, oh, you know, these guys will take me, right? I failed the drug test. They wouldn't take me.
Yeah.
And so then it was like, all right, I guess I have to break down and tell somebody that I have a problem and I need help. Cause people want to kick my ass and possibly like kill me. Cause I was robbing people, like, you know,
and stuff. And
yeah. You know, and yeah, I mean,
especially amongst a bunch of addicts who are unpredictable anyways, like you're asking me to kill.
Yeah, it might've been Long Island, but it was still, we didn't have gangs, but there were just certain people that like,
right.
You knew who their family was and you'd be stupid to do anything, right? Because they might find you in the trunk of a car or in the river, right? So, and that is kind of, you know, that's how I got connected in Queens and New York City and all that stuff. So, you know, I usually, it's interesting because I don't talk about all that. I try not to glorify it and really go there, like war story stuff but just to talk about the seriousness, like the danger of it. Like I, you know, at the end of the day, I was a kid. Well, I was a young man, but I was in over my head, right?
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
I was thinking I was a tough guy and I had a lot of life lessons to learn. And really, you know, I believe my uncle saved my life when he put me on that airplane and got me to Denver. But to answer your question, I really went to rehab. I think I remember thinking while I was there, this is going to be great. I'm going to learn how to not use coke so I can go back and make that much. I can actually make money now when I go home and sell it. Like it was like the life, it was the lifestyle that I didn't want to leave. I wanted to learn how not to do it. Cause at the end of the day, I was like my best customer. It didn't matter how much I came up one night, you know, I'd be in a hotel room the next 2 days. Yeah. So I never really got anywhere. You know, when you're 17, 18 years old and you got $1,000 in your pocket and a couple, I called it my Mr. T starter kit. You know, I had a couple gold chains. A gold ring, you know, or my uncle actually, he called it my Mr. T starting kit. But anyways, yeah, so I'm in Colorado and in and out of jail. A couple years later, about, I guess it was 94, because that's when my first son was born, got together with my first wife, have our first son. I'm addicted to crack. I'm a crackhead. And I'm trying to get a real job and not do crack. That's not working out real well. You know, I'm working for a week, getting a paycheck, binging, not coming home. So we move up to the western slope of Colorado, and that's where I am today, you know, to get out of the city. So now we're trying to do the geographic thing, right? Like if we just move out of the city, then I won't have the temptation, right? All those people, places, and things.
We did right? The same thing. Yeah, we moved to Florida thinking we can run away from the problem, right?
Really?
But wherever you go, there you are.
You're bringing yourself and your baggage with you, right? And we'll find those people, right? Like, you know, if we want to find dope, we're going to find it. And so it doesn't matter. You can put me anywhere on the planet, you know? So that was an issue. So we moved to the mountains. You know, beautiful mountains. I get a job as a carpenter's helper. I don't even know how to read a tape measure. Like I didn't know what kind of hammer to buy. Like, it's just like, okay, I'm going to go to work. And this is, you know, I guess this is what grown men do. I don't know necessarily being a carpenter, but I needed a job and I was able-bodied. So I'm like, I'll learn a trade. So now I'm working on these multi-million dollar houses up in Aspen, Colorado on these framing crews. And there's powder cocaine just like everywhere in Aspen on the job site, you know. So I'm like, okay, well, this is a step up. Like, I'm not smoking crack, right? And I have a wife, and she was pregnant with our second son. And I got arrested in Aspen. I write about it in my book that we could talk about later. It was less than a half gram of coke. I mean, back then it was a felony conviction. I don't think it's a felony today, like under a certain amount of weight. But, you know, I had a bindle in my pocket and I was tweaking, and I got the police's attention and they searched me. And so this is my first felony conviction now. That was in 1996. But I was working, I had a young family. They let me out they gave me a deferred sentence. You know, they said, well, you know, just go to your classes, take UAs, and in a couple years, this charge could be dropped. You won't have to do any prison time. But, you know, I'm happy. I get out. I'm smoking weed every day. I'm still being me. I start failing UAs. They put me in the county jail. They send me to a halfway house. I take off from the halfway house. I was back and forth. I violated that probation 5 times. Fast forward, you know, a year and a half later, 2 years later, the judge is like, you leave me no choice. I got to send you to DOC, Department of Corrections. You know, I had a 2 to 6 year sentence. So my first sentence was 2.5 years. They sent me to Buena Vista Correctional Facility, which I don't know if they still call it this, but back then it was called Gladiator School. Yeah. And that was like, I've been to the county jail, you know, and I've been to city jail, and that wasn't fun. But, you know, pulling up the first time and seeing the rolls of razor wire and just thinking, like, you know, when those gates open, they're putting me in there, and like, this is my home for the next couple of years, you know. And I remember walking in like with a bedroll, you know, they give you the mattress that's rolled up and your blankets and your pillow. You're going to, when you come into your first unit, and it's 3 tiers high and there's 300 guys, and they're all like looking at the new guy. And this is just one pod. There was 4 buildings like that. There was like 1200 inmates in that prison. And I mean, again, it's not, you know, it's not LA, you know, it's not California, but it's still, it was prison.
This is your first time to prison, right?
Yeah. So that was late 98, you know, but so basically just from 1998 to 2011, I was in and out of prison 7 different times. And so it would be, And let, you know, and I'd like to add, just because it's part of my story and part of why I do the work that I do today, you know, 4 of those 7 times were parole violations, you know, where they just sent me back because I violated. But I was also released homeless 4 of those times. So again, like, I'd get out to the community, I'd find a job, I'd get in recovery, I'd work, I'd get a car, I'd pay rent, you know, maybe a couple months, I'd make it. And then I'd go on a binge. I'd lose all my, you know, then I'd go back to county jail. I'd lose my apartment, lose all my stuff. So I never really did more. I never did more than, you know, 2.5 years in one sentence. But going in and out and losing all your stuff. And again, getting back out and having that piece of paper and expecting to jump through the hoops, you know, and then in my 30s, probably after I'd been to prison, after I went to prison the second time, because I was never into meth, but then I tried meth. I met some guys that were selling meth, and then I got into meth. I was smoking crack and meth, but I started dealing meth. Man, that was a whole nother crazy world of people too. I don't know if you have any experience with that. Crackheads were bad, but I was like a street crackhead. I was behind the dumpster. I was blisters on my feet, down and out, walking around for days. I was like the street kind of guy, believe it or not, back in the day, because I would just let myself go. There were times where I just walked into the police station and I was like, there's a warrant out for me. I can't do this anymore. I'm dying. Like, put me in jail.
I've heard of people doing that because they want the meal and the shelter, right?
Place to sleep. It's just once I needed medical attention. I once got impaled on a fence, man. Someone was chasing me, you know, and I tried to hop this metal fence, this iron fence, and I fell and got caught on my thigh. I've got a scar like this. I was hanging upside down, you know, and I was I thought I was going to bleed out. I got some war stories, but it was just like, you know. So I knew how to survive on the streets. That was a sick comfort zone. And then I started acclimating to going to prison because prison could be a rough and dangerous place too. The streets were dangerous, but I felt comfortable on the streets and would get high on the streets, even though I'd tweak out and I'd be paranoid and everything that comes with it. But when I went to prison, like I was highly functional and I wouldn't get high. Even though you can get dope in prison.
So you wouldn't do drugs in prison?
No, it's interesting because it was like when I'd go to prison, I was like, okay, I'm just going to eat. I'm going to work out. You know, I got into I'm a faith-based guy today. Like I started reading, you know, the Bible and I was one of those guys where I was trying to figure out this whole spirituality thing No, I wanted to be on point. Like I saw some guys get beat down and get hurt in prison. I didn't want to be one of those guys. I'm of the Christian faith today, but I was born and raised. I'm from a Jewish family, so I'm a white guy with a Jewish last name. And when you're in prison, it's segregated. You know, you got the white supremacists. And then you got like the black gangs, and then you got the Mexican gangs, and you're either clicking up or you're not, and you better carry yourself appropriately because no one's got your back. It's an interesting. I know what the right, you know, it's a culture of itself. They segregate themselves, and you know, I just rolled where, you know, my two older sons are Hispanic. You know, one of my best friends is African American. Like I've never played the racist card. I'm not racist. I tried to be friends with everybody. And also in the prison system, I was diagnosed with bipolar and PTSD. So I'd go, and I don't think I was properly diagnosed, and I could tell you why here in a minute, but so I'd go from like binging on crack and meth and being strung out, and then, you know, going into jail, being cut off, you know, cold turkey, not being able to sleep, having nightmares, you know, being depressed, crashing, right? My dopamine. And then they would, you know, so I got prescribed 2000 milligrams of lithium, and then they would give me Seroquel or Trazodone to sleep at night. So I would go into the prisons. Yeah. Like And again, I had gotten into a fight once on Seroquel. Like I just came back from, I came back from Medline. So the Seroquel was kicking in. I was getting tired. Really? And I didn't have my shoes on. I had my socks on, which means basically when I was trying to grapple with this guy, I just slid on the concrete. Basically, I got my ass kicked, and I vowed like I'm never not going to get my ass kicked again. You know, I'm going to do everything I can not to get my ass kicked, you know?
So in 2011, that's when things turned around for you?
So, yeah, you know, in and out. This was my cycle. In 11, I'm in prison yet again, right? I'm 40 years old. I wake up, you know, all of a sudden I'm 40 years old. When I went to prison the first time, my kids, I think, were 2 and 4. My first wife divorced me the first time I went to prison too, by the way. So I'm in prison. I missed my children's childhood basically. Cause when I was out, I was just on the street, You know, maybe I'd see them once, I'd come visit, you know, but I wasn't a good dad. I wasn't there. I'm in prison. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, I'm 40 years old. I'm getting out again, broke, homeless. My oldest son was a senior in high school in this community where I'm at now. And I thought it was the first time I was off parole in 10 years. So what that means is I could move wherever I wanted. When you're on parole, you got to parole back to whatever city you got arrested in. Especially if you don't have any family or anywhere to go, they just send you.
Even if you're just in town on vacation, you'd have to go back to that same spot for transfer?
Well, yeah, you could try. They call it an interstate compact. So like if you were in town, but you'd have to have a family, and you have to have letters coming in saying, hey, he can move here and live with us. The parole department in whatever state that is has to be willing to take you on their caseload.
Got it.
Is really what it is. Because sometimes people are like, no, they're interstate. They have family. They have a job waiting for them. And parole's like, no, we don't want that guy. We got enough going on. So I know people that are kind of like stuck in Colorado. They're not even from Colorado.
The system, but they're just stuck there.
Yeah. And they have a place to go, you know? So in my circumstances, I didn't have any money or anything, but the state, by the way, because of my diagnosis of bipolar and PTSD, I guess they applied for me to be on SSI, Social Security, saying I was too mentally unstable to work. And so when I got out, I got a $700 a month check and like $300 or a couple hundred dollars in food stamps. I moved up to the mountains and I stayed at a hostel in the town where my kids go to school. I rented a cot for like $35 a night. And I went to duly diagnosed groups. I went to individual counseling, you know, went to church, went to AA. I say AA because it was the only meeting in our town. And that's kind of part of the story. Like there was either AA or like Celebrate Recovery, right? And I didn't know of any other kind of recovery resources or that there was other pathways to recovery. And, you know, and that was the first year, by the way, while I was still in Denver, before I came up to the mountains, I did like a month of Krav Maga lessons. And Krav Maga is a self-defense system, this, you know, because I always...
Dance, right? Like, uh-huh. they use it as, isn't it kind of known as like fight dancing, like dance fighting?
No, I think, and I don't know the name of it, but I think there's a Brazilian art. Or there, it might be something else too. There might, but Krav Maga, and I don't want to get into politics or anything like that. Krav Maga was created for the Israeli military. It was created by an Eastern European Jew who escaped the Nazis and was bare knuckle boxing on the beaches of Palestine back in the day. He before Israel was Israel, like a state or officially a state. Before 1948, and the Jewish underground saw this guy that people were betting on him. He was a wrestler and a boxer, and his dad actually had a judo and jiu-jitsu gym in Bratislava, which would be like Czechoslovakia back in the air, getting a little Krav lesson. They recruited him to work for them. And in 1948, when Israel became an official country, you know, recognized by the United Nations, they put him in charge of physical fitness and the hand-to-hand combat self-defense training. And his name was Emi Lichtenfeld. And from Emi, he introduced his system was called Krav Maga. And in Hebrew, it means contact combat. And so basically, it's hardcore, like, self-defense system. There's not tournaments. There's not, you know, you don't, it's basically what people would call like dirty fighting. It's like survival. Like they're going to go after your eyes, your throat, your knee. We don't want to fight, but if we have to fight, like, you know, they teach you to the best of their ability how to survive. Because you have to understand, like, as soon as Israel became a state in 1948, they were attacked by all their neighbors. And so you had, whoever wanted to live in Israel and, you know, and was Jewish, they had to fight. And then you had Holocaust survivors. So they had to create a system that would be easy to learn, effective, you know, and couldn't take like years to learn. Anyways, that's my Krav Maga lesson. While I was homeless, when I was 40, before I moved up to the mountains to reunite with my kids, I really just wanted to reconcile with my sons before it was too late. My older son was in 12th grade. My younger one was in 10th grade. And I took Krav for like a month and fell in love with it. And I found the words Krav Maga in a book that I was reading about the Mossad. You know, all my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. Part of the story I didn't tell you, right? Eastern German Jews, Polish, Hungarian Jews. And so this was kind of like, I kind of was kicked out of my tribe, so to speak, right? Like I was cut off from my family. And this was kind of like part of the new me, right? Reconnecting to my heritage. You know, through that, it helped build my self-confidence, my self-worth. Like, yes, I'm 40 years old, but I am capable of learning something new. Right. And so I moved up to the mountains. I only did it for about a month, but I fell in love with it. And I came up here. There was nowhere to take classes. Nobody was teaching it. And so I'm on SSI and I wanted to get off SSI. I didn't want to be broke. And so I started working as a carpenter again. And then it was my first time like going online. You know, I was computer illiterate. But I found a Krav Maga organization. I reached out to the ones in Israel, and because I was a convicted felon, they wouldn't allow me to come over and train. They were going to do like weapons defenses, and you got to, you know, they do like, you know, handgun, assault rifles, knife defenses. Like, but I found an organization in the United States that was willing to work with me. And so I flew out of state and got my level one instructor course. Certificate to be an instructor. And I came back here and I just started a class at the community center because I thought if I want to get to the next level, I need people to train with. It really wasn't about making money, but I wanted to teach and I needed other bodies like to test my techniques on. So long story short, I started shooting videos in my backyard. I'm reconnecting with my kids. But going back to recovery, I'm getting 3 months clean and then I'm relapsing. And then I'd get 6 months clean and then I'm relapsing. Like I still was like trying to do it my way. Like I wanted, you know, what's to say? I wanted my cake or, you know, and I wanted to eat it too. Or I thought I was all in. As I started building, I started my own Krav Maga organization called American Krav Maga. And I started putting out videos like, you know, if a guy like me can do this, a guy that's been to prison 7 times in a rural community, you can teach this in your community. And I created like an instructor course and on Facebook. That's how I like got introduced to Facebook. And before I knew it, I had a guy in California hit me up. He was like, hey, like I can't afford to own my own gym, but I got people and I could teach out of like our community center or our church. I had a guy in New York that was teaching out of his garage. Before I knew it, these guys were like, I went to Montana and then I started doing like seminars. So by the time I was 46, I got my first black belt. I landed a trip to go teach in Argentina. I went down to Buenos Aires, taught down there, met some guys in the Netherlands. I've been to Mexico, Europe, started traveling. When I was traveling, I was trying not to use, but I was using too, because then I was like, away from home, right? It got to where, and by the way, part of the story, and there's so much in here, I apologize. I was into anabolic steroids too. So I was doing coke, I was taking steroids. Basically, I was killing myself to fulfill this persona that I thought I needed to be, I guess. Because I created this image and I was trying to maintain this image. You know, and I was a little insecure, like I'm in my 40s, like, you know, and then I got a job. I got a job running nightclub security at a club because I wanted to see, okay, because I'm hitting pads and we're, you know, I'm in the dojo training, but I want to go hands on and I don't want to go to jail, right? I don't want to get arrested either. I'm like, hey, I used to bounce at some bars back in the day, but I was in my 20s, you know, so now I'm this old man coming in here. But we were getting down. It was like Roadhouse some weekends, you know, but I was doing coke. I was taking steroids. And actually in 18, I didn't share this with you guys. I self-published a book called The Pitbull Bouncer. You know, I forget the subtitle, but you know, like, lessons for like nightclub security, and just has some, it's like in an interview fashion. And I did that with a guy that I knew from training, Krav Maga. And I became a certified law enforcement instructor. I've taught at the police academy here, despite my felonies. So all this, even though I was using, it was still like, I knew I was capable of, I guess, creating something. If I had a vision, and I guess another message is like, it's never too late. Like I was 46 years old when I got my first black belt. I now have three black belts in Krav Maga for three different organizations. I got inducted into the United States Martial Arts Hall of Fame for, I was putting out like my stuff all over the world. I got friends all over now from that. But in 2018, so I worked my way up from like this rowdy, rough bar, you know, literally making $13 an hour. Like, it wasn't about the money. It was really about the action. Like, I wanted, and I guess it was an excuse to do coke every weekend. Cause it was like, it wasn't like I was going to the bar. I was going to work, right? It was like an addiction trap, because the alternative to working at the bar, well, I started getting recognized. Somebody named me the pit bull because I was pretty aggressive, and word got out, and I started applying to clubs up in Aspen, and I got like private music venues. Like one night Snoop Dogg and Nelly came to town, and I got to like work their table, and act the different actresses when they would come to town. So now I'm doing high end stuff and making more money doing it. But in 2018, right after my book came out, I overdosed on cocaine. I went and told my supervisor, and they're like, you can't do that, right? You can't, that's crossing boundaries. You can't just bring somebody to your house.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than two decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.